It's 6 o'clock, and we want to welcome everybody out to City Council this evening. Appreciate all of you that are here. We're going to begin with invocation and the Pledge of Allegiance, and John Valenti is offered to lead us in that.
Almighty God, Heavenly Father, we humbly pray for your guidance, wisdom, and direction. As we gather in this City Council meeting, we ask for peace and unity among all members. We acknowledge the diverse religious beliefs, backgrounds, and life experience of individual council members. Because of these differences, we will often see issues before us very differently and hold strong and differing opinions based on our perceptions. We are thankful for the support of the city's employees in our endeavors, and we recognize their knowledge and commitment. We also recognize those in law enforcement who protect and defend our city and keep us safe. We are thankful to live in this city with all its natural beauty, but especially in this desert community, we pray for the rains and snow without which we would not survive. Help us to listen with compassion, speak with respect, and work collaboratively for the betterment of our community. May our decisions demonstrate reverence for individual citizens. We pray our actions will reflect kindness and understanding and serve the community, fostering harmony and strength within our city. For these things we pray in your holy name. Amen.
Amen.
Please join me in the pledge. Ready? Begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We failed to have our fire district on the agenda this evening, but we'd like to have you report if you'd like to come.
So, we didn't have a fire before the meeting because we didn't have a quorum. So we're still waiting on all the applicants that were sent to the county commission to be approved by the county commissioners. They met yesterday, but I didn't see that on the agenda. So we anticipate that the next meeting. So that may hold us back even farther. We generally meet the first Monday of every month, but if we put another point right in, there's plenty of points to meet. So, just a short, give you a little bit of statistics. We had a total of 55 calls in the city of Overton. Two of them were fires, 37 were EMS, and then 16 were just other hazards that we responded on. And throughout the entire district, we responded on 517 calls for service, which is up about 5% of the normal review. This is early detail, but we anticipate to be busier than what we were last year. If anybody has any questions for me or concerns?
Any questions for the fire district?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Next item on the agenda this evening is the consent agenda. Unless there's any discussion, we can have a single motion for that. Is there any discussion on the consent agenda? No, I'll entertain a motion then to accept it.
Mayor, I'll make a motion that we approve the consent agenda, including the declarations of conflict of interest, agenda, meeting minutes of January 21st, 2026, work and regular meetings, and checks and invoices in the amount of $120,219.15.
You have a second?
I'll second it.
The motion is a second. John?
Yes.
Amanda?
Yes.
Baron?
Yes.
Okay. The first item on the business this evening is discussion and possible action to set a public hearing for the secondary water feasibility study, user rate analysis, and impact fee analysis, and impact fee facility plan. One thing you made on that, Derek, I know that we discussed, we had a work meeting on that last time, went over study. I believe the feeling of the council was that we needed to accept it, but as far as user rate analysis and impact fees, we were possibly going to wait to implement those until we get the new system operation. Yeah. Is that correct?
Yeah, we just wanted to have, if we're going to, our thoughts are if we're going to raise the rate, we better have a more reliable system that has the ability to stay on longer and be cleaner for people to use. So we figure we ought to wait for that to get finished, then go back through the process to raise it to address those impact and the rate and structure.
But we can still have a public hearing to accept the study.
The plan is to hold, yeah, without
okay.
that.
Any discussion from the council on that?
My only concern is that this is just, we're just saying this was a study, we accept the study that they've done. There's no impact on it on the citizens right now insofar as rates or expenses or anything. Mm-hmm. So we're just saying we kind of commissioned this study and we're going to accept it.
You'd have to have a public hearing to enact those other two anyway. So.
Yeah. If I could maybe take a second just kind of further clarify this. Under the Utah Impact Fee Act, that the water feasibility study, the user rate analysis, and the impact fee analysis can all be approved at a regular meeting without the need for a public hearing, because it's just a study, it's just an analysis. But in order to approve the impact fee facilities plan, and then along with that, there will have to be some sort of ordinance or impact fee enactment to put it all in motion. Those two things need to be approved at a public hearing after public notice is given. There has to be a summary published that goes along with that and posted in three locations and so forth. So, yeah, if you wanted to approve the water feasibility study, the user rate analysis, and the impact fee analysis tonight, you could do that. But in order to approve the impact fee facilities plan and then the impact fee enactment, that's when we need to set for a public hearing downstream a bit and make sure we have a summary, give public notice, and then have that public hearing.
The impact fees wouldn't affect the rates right now, so we could actually probably do that at a public hearing and then have another public hearing for the rate after we get the system.
There's nothing in the Utah law that says you have to pass all of these within, you know, a certain time of each other. You could approve the feasibility study, the rate analysis, and the impact fee analysis tonight, and then you could set for public hearing, you know, a month down the road if you wanted. However much time you felt like you needed to really look at it, go over it.
Well, then I think I'd like to make a motion that we accept the, what were the three things?
It's the
impact.
It's the secondary water feasibility study.
Secondary water feasibility study.
The user rate analysis.
The user rate analysis.
And the impact fee analysis.
And the impact fee analysis.
If I might, just one more comment. This study was accomplished when we were planning to pay for the new system through this fee. The new system is now going to be totally absorbed by the district. So that $21 million, Blaine explained it, the slate is kind of wiped clean.
Right.
So as long as there's further discussion about the rate
and
how much money we actually need for the...
And I would love to discuss if there's a way we could keep that as low as possible.
And I think that's the desire of all of us, to keep it as low as possible. We still have got to put it to where it's going to pay for itself.
Yeah.
And so far with the system we have now, we've always had a shortfall every year as far as repair and replacements. And so it's all, the shortfalls come out of the general fund. So, we really need to make sure that the water fund pays for itself. And we set aside money for to replace it over time, and we need to do the same thing, I think, with the that's one of the biggest problems that just about every city in the state has had, is that they haven't put aside money for replacement over time. And that's something that the state's been preaching for, as I know, they've been preaching for at least 20 years. Sure. And they're getting any more. If we want to go get any help from the state to do a project, if you don't have your rates where they need to be, you don't get the money until you put them there. And so we just need to make sure that we're treating the citizens correctly. We don't want to charge more than we need to be charging, but we do need to cover our costs and and at least set some aside for future replacement, because over time, and this system is going to, once you get it in, it'll last for 50 years or longer. The one we've got in now is probably 40 years old, I'm guessing. Is that correct?
Done in the mid-80s.
Mid-80s, and so...
About 40 years.
It's only 28 years.
Mid-80s.
I wish.
But, and we all know it's not adequate for what we really need right now. So,
yeah, sure.
And that's, had they been charging enough over time, put the money aside for that, then the replacement would have been, we would have money to start replacing things over time like that. And that's the, what the state wants us to do. But, you know, we, a lot of these projects you just can't do unless you get state help and get bonding and pay it back to them over 20, 30 years. So,
all right, so with that, I'll second your motion.
So we have a motion and a second, and so
there's no money involved.
There's no money involved, so all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
No opposed. Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair, do we want to set a date for the public hearing, or do you want to give it some more thought and then
well,
set a date?
You mentioned something about the impact fees. Once we accept those, or the impact fees, it takes 90 days before they go into effect. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Do we want to set a public hearing and get that taken care of? Or
I'd like to get with you and Kyle, because Kyle budgets off of so many building permits and the irrigation impact fees are off the existing amounts that we have now. So depending on the zone you're in, you're either going to get charged upwards to $1,000 down to $600. The new impact fees, because they now include the commercial, are going to drop the residential down to around $200. So there's going to be, and we don't know with certainty how many of the commercial businesses are going to be coming in to make up the other part of it. So I just wanted to do kind of a, get with you and do a kind of a cost breakdown using both numbers.
If you adopt those impact fees, it would definitely affect the budget in the irrigation budget negatively, because the impact wouldn't be enacted for the commercial yet, but it would be enacted for the residential to go down, so you won't have that offset that would create the budget to keep it where it is. So you may want to consider that when you're doing it, because
maybe we can make a
less money.
We're going to have a budget retreat here in what, a few weeks?
On the 25th.
And maybe we can discuss it at the budget retreat and make a decision as to when we want to set that public hearing. And then we could go from there. But
I'll add that to the.
That'll give us some time to look at it and make sure that budget wise.
Because the commercial only about 1,500 to 2,000 pending the connection size. So it may or may not, depending on how many commercial businesses offset the loss that we're going to have in the residential side.
Okay. Does that sound okay with everybody?
Yeah.
All right. Okay, we'll move on to the next item. It's a discussion regarding an amendment to the Lorton City Code by removing, adding, replacing the following terms in Section 8-1-4, Statement of Charges, Delinquencies, and providing an effective date. Who's got that?
I do.
Okay.
So I don't know if anybody had a chance to read the little synopsis I put. That's a new word I learned today. We went to PERC, so I'm still picking up on me. Breaking it down, so basically, right now, the only way we have to get notice out to the citizens, according to the code, is through the mail and through door hangers. And so I had Lisa put something together that she averages 125 shut-off letters that she sends out every month to the people that are getting late or are late with their payment. And then prior, 48 hours prior to the shutoffs happening, we have averaged 73 door hangers a month that our crew goes out in places. So Lisa puts approximately 3 or 4 hours a month into this, and my crew puts in, it takes two guys about 6 hours because it's all over town. There's a cost savings of around $6,000 if we decided to go with, and what we changed it to would be that it would be sent out by mail and or electronically. And our plan would be to use Yakify, and in that synopsis I sent out to you, I gave you the explanation of what Yakify was. Some of you may have availability of that, so like when we get water breaks or there are things happening, we can send out texts, we can send out letters, we can send out postcards. There's a ton of ways that we can do it electronically that is not going to cost the city the money putting it through the mail or the crew manpower to go out and put it on the doors. Plus, we do receive back a third of all the letters that we sent out due to the fact that they said that those addresses don't exist. So we thought this might be the better route to go, saving time and money by doing this. And Yakify, just so you know, was a state program. They basically gave it to the Conservancy District to use for 3 years, and it was built, and it was for water usage mainly, and for getting things out to people to conserve water. The 3 years is up, so the city now is going to have to invest in a partial part of this, and Conservancy will cover half, and we'll do half. But it gives us more freedom to do things like this, which is a good resource, because we can pick and choose all areas that are going to be impacted by water shutoffs or by crack sealing or whatever it is. This makes more sense. And then those that aren't getting the text or the notification, we still have to do the ordinary. So they're still going to get it one way or the other. There's just a potential for a lot of savings and time.
And I think when we do those, some people just aren't aware of getting hooked up, so we don't have an email address or a cell phone for them. But what we intend on doing is, once we take the door hanger, is having some sort of a note on there that if they would call and let the city have an email address or a cell phone, then they would get it electronically. And it would honestly probably reach people with the text more than the door hangers. The door hangers sometimes blow off or that kind of thing. So.
And I think right now we have 92% of people's information to get out that we got out through the Yakify. Now, whether they pick or choose to accept it or go out of it is up to them, but we still have a pretty high percentage that are the town itself.
So all you need is a cell phone number to be able to notify them by text, is that correct?
And cell phone or email.
Yeah.
Because it can go either way.
Yeah. Okay. Any discussion?
I have two questions. Does Yakify allow a feature like when I send out a constant contact, it tells me who opened the email? Do you know if there's any system in there where you can see that they've opened it?
I don't know, but I can check into it. I don't think that there is, because there's no way for like the citizens to communicate back through Yakify to kind of a one-way system. But I can check and see. I'm not that.
Okay. So. And then this is a question for Faye. Legally, do we need to contact them by mail, or is it fine to do electronically?
What are we talking about?
We're talking about notifying people who are delinquent on their bills by email or text instead of letters and putting a notice on their doors.
I don't think it has to be necessarily on the door. or by certified mail. We just have to give notice that's reasonably calculated to get to that person. So if we have a history of dealing back and forth, we email with a certain person, and then we send that notice out by email, that's going to be sufficient. Now, generally speaking, we like to cover ourselves and do it in letter form and either make sure it gets sent certified mail or we hand deliver it just so we have a record to know that it was delivered.
So
but it's not necessarily required that we do that way.
Yeah, and this is just changing the code so we can do it electronically.
Yeah, it's not mandating. That's the only way it says by mail or electronically. You know, so, I mean, still people, they're still going to get notifications. If we can't reach them, they're still going to get the door in here. So they're still going to get notified. And I would imagine we'd have a grace period, you know, as we switch over to this, taking care of that. Because I know a lot of the other cities, like Ivins, is starting to gear up and do something similar. Just for the mere magnitude, they get more response through Yelp Flight than they do through letters and door hangers and things like that. So it's just a more effective way.
I'm all for getting up into the tech age. Does Yelpify cost anything extra to add those extra features of the water or the delinquency notices?
No, because that's the beauty of being passed up 3-year time frame where we're restricted to when we could put out.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to be a paying participant now. It's going to be about $4,500 a year. We're paying half, and then the district could pay $4,500
okay.
for the other half just because they like the fact that they can monitor and we can all get the same messages out and stuff. So as long as we pay our bill, we're good to go.
Okay, and my only other question is kind of fitting with number 5 here, is there going to be personal information that's relayed on the Yelpify? Like, I'm guessing first name, last name, phone number, is there grammar issues or violations or concerns? Like, is it secure app?
Each one is, like, will this take the address? Or, yes, because it goes to the address, then it may not be that particular person, depending on if it's a rental or, you know, however they work it, and we just put it into a file, and then we send the file out as a whole. So the only person that's going to get what we're sending out are those that are supposed to be getting it individually and not sharing any other information. So there's really not names attached to it. It's more addresses attached to it.
What's the capabilities of Yelpify? I'm thinking maybe bigger term. Let's say like an emergency response kind of communication, or let's say like as we start doing major infrastructure projects throughout the city, are we able to geographically choose, you know, yes, folks and be able to put in notices of outages and things like that as well?
So yeah, now that we're open past that trial period, we can use it for anything. So we've used it for breaks because we know the exact area that's impacted by the break, so we can circle the area, type a message, hit send, and it goes to those people.
Yeah.
Just in that area. We do the same thing with our slurry project because people like to follow us when we're slurrying. We are specific. We actually send out the map of where we're slurrying, the days we're slurrying, like that, so that they're prepared. So we can get basically anything out there that we need to get out there. And it's specific to area or the city as a whole.
Any other comments? Okay, I entertain a motion to approve.
I'll make a motion to approve the Vernon City Code by removing, adding, or replacing terms in 814, statement of charges, delinquency, and providing effective.
There wasn't any action.
There was?
Oh,
this is just discussion.
Oh, okay.
Did we decide this didn't have to go to public hearing, right?
Yeah, it does not.
And the cemetery doesn't need.
Pardon me?
The cemetery didn't need to?
No, the cemetery does not.
Oh, so we need to put it on an agenda for action. Is that correct?
Okay. I'm sorry. You talking about the other cemetery?
No, this one is just for discussion. So we can't make any motion on this. Is that right? Can we approve it or not?
You're talking about item number 2?
Yes.
It's a discussion item only.
Okay.
Same with number three.
Yeah, I think the intent was to get the information to you and number four. And if you have questions, you have time to think about it before it brought back to you.
Okay. So we'll just have to bring it up for approval or next meeting then. Okay. Next item is discussion only again regarding the amendment to the cemetery rules and regulations. We did talk about that previously, but
no, so nobody got back to me with any concerns or issues or anything. So what I did is another synopsis page, basically detailing the areas that are being impacted by the changes and stuff. So if you don't have any issues with that and are okay with us moving forward, we would do the same at the next meeting.
Okay.
Yeah, I think my only thing was to add a definition. As I was going through it, it says the cemetery section, and I don't think that's as common of a term. I had to look it up, so I think adding that as a definition, but other than that, I don't think.
Anybody else have any comments?
I did have a concern about the 3 foot, because I was wanting a big one.
You need to reduce.
Just get a wind-up one, bro.
But you know, the height really is an issue, because after you start pushing past 3 feet, of sprinklers can't get there. And so, there, if you notice in the cemetery, there's a lot of dry spots. I mean, you guys can just pick and choose to go whatever height you want. For you, I'm limited.
I'll go down.
And John, do you have any comments? Got anything? No. Okay. All right. We'll move on to the next item in this discussion as well regarding vacating property on 2005 South and 100 East. And Derek will give us the history and everything on that, and we'll just there'll be a discussion item.
So, Kyle's going to put up the map.
Oh.
And the pack, I did hold up or hand you out a packet that's got the map with it. And so what I decided to do is, instead of giving a hug, I want to give just a brief history, and I want it to be very neutral. I want whatever decision going forward to be made by the council. So basically the history is that Teresa Fish, the owner of the property located at 205 South 100 East, submitted an application on November 3rd, 2025. Hence the reason we're going down this road, because she filled out an application. We're responsible to follow up with that application, whether it's for the positive or for the negative. To have the 20-foot access easement on the north side of the property vacated. This 20-foot access easement allows the owner of the adjacent lot to access the property through which is entirely on Teresa land. So that's what her application stated the reason for wanting to vacate. So the history of the property is Steve Sanders built his home located on 205 South 100 East, August 8, 2022, or 2002. The home was built under the flag lot ordinance 10-7-12 because Mr. Sanders would not give us the full frontal property of 100 East, but he had enough property that fronted off the dedicated city street that he qualified for the flag lot exception, which requires 25 foot of the property to be off of the dedicated city street. And then it says the right-of-way or access strip must be used solely for access to the flag lot. Dwelling unit numbers, only one family dwelling unit is allowed on the flag lot. After Mr. Sanders passed away, the property was sold and subsequently divided into two parcels, which required going through the subdivision process. The MIDAR indicated that the dimension of 25.57 feet demonstrated compliance with the necessary 25 foot for flag lot. However, it also shows a 20-foot access easement. And I know this is going to be brought up against me, so I'm just going to get ahead of it. So I was the one for the city that signed the MIDAR, and to this day I still have no idea why that 20-foot access is there. And the engineer that did it from Alpha is no longer living, so I can't ask him either for why we did what we did. But it is there. It does have my signature on it, just so you know. So. But I still don't, even looking at it, I still understand the intent of that with this being a flag lot. So under the provision of the owner's dedication, it states that here that that hereby dedicates and conveys to the city of Leverk and for perpetual public use all easements shown on this lot. The city has conveyed all easements during dedication, including 20-foot access easement, for perpetual public use through dedication. However, since the city currently has no utility or infrastructure within its access easement, there is no need for public usage. Now, I've battled this in my head for the last week. I've been dealing with this since, but this issue comes up with me, since November. And I've also dealt with the property owner above with his attorney. We had a pretty lengthy discussion on it. And I just want to leave you with this going forward. So if the city decides to vacate this access easement, there's a possibility of legal actions being taken. Therefore, the crucial question is whether vacating an access easement is in the best interest of the city as a whole, considering the potential cost involved. Ultimately, may be more beneficial for the matter to be resolved, if possible, between the two parties without the city's involvement. So just throwing that out there, as far as staff being on just me, my own thing. I'm neutral. I see both sides of the situation. And so, anyway.
Derek, I just have a question, if I might. Is that, would there ever be able to be anything besides access used on that property, or is it just access only, or is it, would utilities ever be in that even?
Unless they bought property to the north of them, they could not run any utilities up that access easement because it's just access. Now, if we vacated it, if we didn't vacate it and it's still an access there, the primary access is going to be further south, but about around 200 feet of property, and they still would be charged the infrastructure cost of curb, gutter, sidewalk.
For that 200 feet. Mm-hmm.
So.
Can I just add a couple of points here before we talk about this? In order to vacate this public easement, which has been dedicated to the city as a public utility, public right-of-way, Utah Code basically says that there are three requirements. First of all, there has to be a petition to vacate. To vacate, the petition has to describe it, has to describe all the people who are in favor of it, those opposed, has to have a legal description, all of that. Then there has to be a public notice and a public hearing before it can be vacated. And the city then would have authority at that public hearing to pass an ordinance vacating that easement if, one, the council finds, this is language from the code, the council finds a good cause to vacate. Secondly, the council would have to find that neither the public nor any individual person would suffer any detriment or be materially injured by the vacation. If we can make those two findings, then we can vacate that easement.
Is there any way that they could legally access that property through that 20-foot easement if they were to build on the property above there? Because we already have a flag lot, that would be another flag lot. So that goes against our code to have more than one building on a flag lot. Is that correct?
With respect to the flag lot, I'll let Derek answer
that. That is correct, but I might have put us in a bad position.
But the language on the plat says that it's been dedicated for the use and benefit of the public, as shown on the plat, shown on the plat specifically as an access. Now, access generally in legal terms means ingress and egress. Doesn't mean utilities.
I guess my other question is according to this map here, the property to the south of Teresa Fish's house is owned by Alan Olson, correct? And That property goes up the hill and behind Teresa Fish's house, so the property behind her house, or up the, on the east side of her house, could be accessed through that property if they didn't have it. Is that right?
If there were no access easement, if
yeah.
we vacated it?
Yeah.
Yeah, they'd have access down through off of Mashiwotos and over street.
100 East.
So that would go towards a finding that no one is materially injured by vacating the right of way.
And could we as a city even approve another flag lot off of that? That would be against our code, is that right? Our city code.
Yeah, if we can approve any more access to go to
a building?
A building up on top, but that wouldn't stop them from using that for access to the property. But the primary access would be down below,
towards the south.
Yeah.
The process, are they looking to sell that piece of land to another owner? Is that?
Maybe. Alan, would you like to come up? Maybe we could ask you a few questions on that. And. What is your intent with the property as a whole? Or
first of all, everybody familiar with the map?
We're looking at a copy of it here with
that's
yeah. Sure.
This is the property collection right here. This is the 100. This is the Louisa right there, which is all, the elevation is all below her house. So it doesn't really encroach on her property at all. It gives it access to this property here. And then there is any access there. Back in 2014, I put in a retaining wall, and a road. And it cost me about $18,000.
Where's the retaining wall on the road you're talking about?
On the driveway. The easement is actually an extension of 200. It just goes straight up. And her house is up about 15 feet.
So you have an additional 20 feet onto her 25 feet?
I have the my gate to the property house down the hill.
It's a really weird shaped lot.
I can see that, but what I'm saying, in order for you to get to your easement, your 20-foot easement, you have to go on the 25-foot roads that she's got to access her house. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know if it's 25 feet. I've never mentioned it, but
25.
I think it's more like 20 feet.
It's been eight.
Let's see what's right here, and this is the easement. It goes right there. And it just comes up to my gate here.
Okay, but she has a 25-foot easement to get to her house. Well, it's not an easement. She owns the property.
Yeah.
A 25-foot property to get there. So you have to travel on her property to get to your easement.
That's... an easement to the property. That goes without saying. You have an easement.
But you don't have an easement on her.
Sure.
I have an easement.
I have an
easement through that, 25-foot access
you do.
To my property.
Oh, yeah, come up here.
Yeah.
So you have...
So
is your intent to subdivide the whole property you have there?
No.
Make more than one lot or
no? Well, if it did, there'd be access to it, but that wasn't my plan. I was planning to put a home or two on that.
Or two? So
yeah.
In order to do that, you'd have to come to the south of Teresa Fish property to do that.
Well, where the easement is, and that's why.
Where the what is?
That's where the easement is on that 25.
That's on the north of her property.
Yeah, you, that's on the north. That's
you wouldn't be able to subdivide and use that as a an access to the subdivision.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't be able, I don't have the 25 feet, and I do now. It makes a thoroughfare. It goes in one side and out the other. I have access. That was, I thought I did that according, I mean, I did that because I thought that sometimes if I didn't have a house there, and Derek was the one that told me I have access, I wouldn't have to put a turnaround there because I would have a complete room. It would come off one side and down the other. Mm-hmm. That way you wouldn't have to have a turnaround.
Does the 20-foot easement meet fire restrictions, fire codes?
Yes. There have been conversations because right now, the way our code is right now is 25 feet. We've been told that that's been reduced to 20 feet. I can't clarify it. But I think the interesting thing, I mean, I think what they're talking about is two different things. So I think if we didn't vacate it, they could still use that to access the property. If they built another house, the primary access would be that 200 feet. That's where they would be.
To the south. You'd have to access, if you built a house, you'd have to access it to the south.
Right. I mean, they could still use that for like what Mr. Olson's saying, you know, loop up and around, but they're going to be responsible. That's going to be, the city will deem that their primary access. They're going to pay the curb, gutter, sidewalk, asphalt, costs associated with that, any utilities that need to go there will all come off of that south end, but they still have the ability to access off the north end, but it's just not the primary access.
But they would have to absorb the curb and gutter cost if they build.
Oh, absolutely. If anybody that builds there is going to be responsible for that.
But if it just remains a dirt road or a paved road and there's no building, that would be.
Right now, if there's no building there, stays as it is. And more than likely, if they come in and build, we will collect the money for the improvements and put it away. So to do that whole thing as a project, because we don't own the rest of the road down there, and we don't want to put curb together and push drainage onto other people's property. So that would be the way to go. So I think what Mr. Olson is saying is that right now would still be used as access to whatever buildings would go up there, but the primary access is going to be down on the south.
So it wouldn't be your primary access, it'd just be a secondary something.
That's right.
Yeah, in order to build there, you're still going to have to put another road up there on the south side. Is that correct? What's that?
Hold on.
We've got to have one at a time. She's got to do the minutes.
Okay.
And they're going to close off the access.
Hey, boys, zip it.
Speak into the mic as you're making your comment. So.
No, I just think, you know, the road has been there for a long time, and if we vacate access, then the folks that own the smaller property will foreclose any use of that road at all. That's how I understand it. And I don't know if that's a good decision for someone who's had, routine access to a road for, a long, long time. Mm-hmm.
How is that gate locked that's on there, or is it open for access?
I left it open, but somebody comes, I think people come and close it all the time.
But it's not locked?
I've left it open. It's not locked.
Okay.
Is there any questions? The road and the easement's been there since I think 2015, but I had the road built and I had the retaining wall put in 2014.
And we just put this back to discussion because we figured there'd be a lot of information that we need you guys to maybe further conversation.
Yeah. And my question too was, is there a plan to sell the property to the other owners or divide it equally between the two parties? Generally, if there's some kind of, I had a similar issue years back where there was a piece of, city property next to me, and the initial, issue with the city was
if we vacate it, each side will just take half of that property.
It's just an easement. Yeah. It's not, the city doesn't own the property. All it is an easement.
No, but once you vacate the property, someone will own that property.
We already own it.
What's that?
I think they already own
it. We're just vacating the easement. We don't own the property.
Okay, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, because there are situations like that where property has been deeded to the city for a future road or something like that, and then it didn't go in. And so that property owners on either side, when it's vacated, the property is vacated that the city owns, goes back to the owners on either side. But whereas an easement, you already own the property.
Well, I originally owned the whole thing.
Correct.
When we sold the house. And then it passed to Roger and Gail, and they signed off on it on the mortgage deed, and then Teresa Fish also signed off on that she recognized that there was an easement and there was no problem. There was a question if she wanted to buy a property and, you know, she couldn't afford it, so we decided against that, and then she wanted to buy the easement. And I said, well, I need the easement because I need access to this side. As the property is sold, since me, everyone signed off on that.
Is your intent to subdivide it now, or is that what it was? You want to build on it, or?
I have been thinking about selling it. I don't really have this resolved.
Scott's going to buy it?
Pardon me?
And Scott's going to buy it?
He'd like to.
He's got a lot of money. Good.
Yeah, money talks.
Yeah. But anyway, he and I are trying to reach an agreement, but, you know, I'd like to sell the property with that access. Mm-hmm. I'd like to have that resolved.
But in order to build on it, you know you'd have to go on the south side or put a road in. So.
Well, Scott realizes that.
You know how to do that? Comment? Scott?
The one thing that stands out to me is, as I've read this, under the owner's dedication, maybe I misunderstood this, but help me out. This was by the owner's own dedication. I think you mentioned this several times, that whoever bought this has understood that this red hatched area that we're talking about here is the area that, as highlighted in our packet, says that we hereby dedicate and convey to the city of Laverne for perpetual use and public use all easements shown on the plot. It goes on to say, all lot easements are, as noted, the owners do hereby warrant to the city of Laverne and all successors and assign title to all property dedicated and conveyed for public use herein against the claims of all persons. So by assigning title to that, there was a question of who owns it. Maybe I misunderstood that, but does, by assigning title, well, just help me out here. Who is the owner of the red hatched area?
Teresa Fish
owns that.
The current owner is Teresa Fish.
Okay, so she owns that, but has given that red hatched area as perpetual easement.
The easement they're talking about is the 20 feet to the east of that in the purple.
No.
Is that
not according to the map? I just looked at the arrow pointed right to that.
I think we're talking about the red hatched area has been dedicated to the city, so there is access from the road up into your property, right? That's how I'm understanding it.
I'll show that map.
So Kel, just to make sure that we're all on the same page right here, as you're looking at this, right?
See the little division between the hatched area and that? That's where my gate is.
Right. That's how I understand. Okay, so this little chunk. So see their property? This access road is what we're talking about. The city has an easement right here to be able to come up and access this piece of property. There's an arrow on there that points right to
it. Teresa owns the 25-foot access.
She may own it, but has dedicated it for the use of perpetual public use on that plot. Am I understanding it's a perpetual public use in her land, this red hash area?
Yeah. Okay. Here's the problem we have with this plat, and this often happens with plats. You have engineers who, when they prepare the plat for recording, they'll borrow language from other plats that they've done and use that as the dedicatory language on the plat. And that seems to be what has happened here. And so you've got elements mixed up here. You've got typically the dedication is you dedicate all easements and rights of way and streets shown on the plat for the use and benefit of the public. You don't dedicate title. You don't give them title. You just give them, typically, it's an easement.
So the property owner has to maintain it and do everything on it. Is that correct?
Well, if the property is unimproved, yeah.
But yet in this instance, they actually have dedicated title, right?
Well, no, I don't think they do. I think because
just the dedicated an easement.
Okay.
The owners do hereby award to the city of Leverkin and the successor to Nassau's title to all property dedicated and conveyed for public use. Okay, so what property is dedicated and conveyed for public use? It's the right-of-way easement. It's the access easement. So I think, while it's confusing, I don't think the city has title to that property.
Okay. However, the red hatched area that is in discussion right here is a public easement. It was, in my mind, reading this, was meant for access for somebody to be able to come up and do just like what you talked about, to be able to make a loop around, not a single point of access, but a loop that goes around to be able to potentially add value to the property. In your description of what we would have to be able to consider if we were to take this to a public hearing, would giving that back to the property owner, would that be something that would be favorable to the current landowner that owns it? Would it have a single benefit to the homeowner that we're talking about here? Those are questions that seem as if they have pretty obvious answers to me. If the city was to give, to lose their claim of the red hatched area, there.
It's not so much a question as to whether or not the property owner next to that red hatched area is going to benefit. The question is, under the statute, by vacating that, are we going to cause any material harm to any individual or to the public by vacating that as a roadway? That's the question.
And that's what Scott's saying, that if you lost that ability to access from both sides, you certainly would be losing value, in my opinion.
Well, that's for the council to make that determination. That's the question.
Help me understand the definition. So in my mind, when we say material, in my mind, I'm associating a property value. Faye, help me understand what that term specifically means.
Well, this is the kind of thing that people wrestle with. Lawyers wrestle with, courts wrestle with. This is the language of the statute. And what does materially mean? That means there has to be some detriment that you can actually look at and ascertain. That would, to me, be a material detriment. But beyond that, I can't really give you a definite answer on that. There is no definition for that in the code.
Okay.
It's just a judgment call on the part of the council. Will somebody be materially injured?
Well, and so, just as we were sitting here, things make sense in math to me. So help just humor me here for just a second. But I noticed that on the map that you guys brought, that the length of the easement is 147.76 feet long. And if it's 25 feet wide, that would constitute 3,699 square feet. If I was to say that a 10,000 square foot building lot sells in the city of Leverkusen for $150,000, it's $15 a square foot is the value of that. That has a value of $55,488 at that idea. What does if that was not to be the case, does that impact the value of the property to the east, $55,000? And in my mind, as we discuss material, does having a looped access or not having a looped access cause material or financial implications to this gentleman? And I suppose that's the question that each of us must answer as we have an opportunity to consider this.
That's the question that the council has to answer.
Okay.
But I don't think you can use that argument, Scott, because they don't own that area.
I understand that, but it does have the... It would have so. Let's say that the property was vacated, so that there was not an easement. While in the definition now it says you cannot park anything in there, you can't use it for something, you can't block it off. Well, that's $55,000 worth of land that then becomes usable. Who would be to say that? Oh, now all of a sudden I can park my trailer in this what was an easement, or what was adjacent to my property but unbuildable. So in my mind, there is $55,000 worth of value to the homeowner if it was to be given back. And once again, as we consider vacating a property, it seems as if it's a lopsided conversation. Who has value? Who doesn't have value? Who's being impacted by it? And I guess that's just where my head went with it. As we consider the issue. So.
There was a question earlier about liability. And if we do vacate it, then there's possible liability from somebody challenging the vacation of the property. If we don't vacate the property, is there a similar liability?
If we don't vacate, there's nothing that requires us to vacate.
That's what I thought. So if we don't vote to vacate, there's no challenge, legal challenge to us.
And so if you subdivided the property and made three or four lots up there...
I'm not going to subdivide it.
Oh, just one lot. If you did one lot, you still have to count.
If I buy it and get a deal with that one, that's something.
Okay, it'd just be like a one lot.
Correct.
Building lot. You'd still have to come off of the other way to get up there. So.
Yeah, I've talked with Derek already. I know that I'm going to have to pay for that road. I already know that.
Yeah.
And I know that the utilities, I know that as well.
And that, all that would do is just help FireWise to give the fire department 100%. An access to go make a loop. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Well, fire department. That's what I had in mind originally, that there'd be access for mail or deliveries or fire emergency vehicles. I didn't have those on them, so it was just sort of making futuristic. So that was what my final rule is. Is there anything that I haven't covered?
No, I appreciate you coming and answering the questions. And,
Mayor,
yes.
Scott, you may have already realized that the Red Cross House area is part of the property. I just didn't bring it all the way down.
Okay.
So I didn't know if that was confusing. Through what you were talking about, I think it is.
So the Red Hash area, say that again, Derek.
It's her property.
Correct. But it is meant for access, correct?
Yes, originally meant for access for to the flag lot only, okay. And then when it divided, that's when this whole different mechanism came into play.
Right.
So
while it is her property, it still isn't available for her to just be able to go, put a tough shed in the middle of it. It has to have access.
I think it's up on a slope. I think you have to go uphill, so it's not even
Well, that's the access to her property for emergency vehicles and anything.
It has to be open for emergency, for everything. You can park on it. You can put anything on it.
She could change the access point to her house just as easy as anything and vacate that if that was her intent. You could look at where the driveway comes in. It could simply go to the west if that was chosen. But because it's dedicated to be like this.
That's actually the to get an access to park the other way.
Sure.
Yeah, I think it's more than 15%.
Gotcha.
So, anyway.
Kelly, can I say something?
Yes.
So I did quite a bit of research on this, trying to figure out what the legalities of it. And I actually went to land use at the county, and we talked about this. And they kind of said the same thing. This probably should be settling in a court of law, not in here. We would definitely open ourselves up to some legalities by vacating this. And they also said you can pretty, even though the arrows were kind of confusing, a 20-foot easement is, and I think you said this too, it's clearly designated for an access. It's not a utility. A 10-foot might be considered a utility, but 20-foot, it was definitely, from the original intent, was to make it an access to the property. So I think that, and then the other thing
primary access.
I know, but and it's similar to a it would be, and you see this in court of law all the time. You have your access, but then you have behind your house an alley, and people have tried to vacate those, and time again you cannot, because it would detriment to that house to lose that access from the alley, and I think this is very similar to that. So I think, as far as the city goes, we would not be wise to get involved in this.
So it would just need to be a civil dispute
between them.
I have one question too, or comment. But according to our hillside ordinance, would they be able to do anything back there anyway? The hillside ordinance would, I think they violated that at one point by leveling out some of the area back there that they did.
Yeah, they're. People that have come in and talked to us, there's definitely going to have to be some reclamation on the hillside that was impacted illegally, along with the historical drainage that got covered up. Our code says that at 30% and above, you cannot dig into the hillside. From 10 to 20, 20 to 30, 30 to 40, there are different steps that you can take to mitigate the retaining the wall, retaining the stuff, so you have the ability to impact the hillside. But there definitely has been a lot of work done up there, so there will be some issues that are going to have to be resolved, whoever decides to develop up there.
Can we comment?
Well, I'm not the chief developer, it's just a house, but I don't know who's seen, but just north of this property, actually, the right in front of Gary Kelsey, that's an impact. I mean, it does the vertical shear.
Well, that was done before we had the hillside ordinance. So.
Well, they're not just saying they're cutting it now.
Yeah, because they're still under the guise of what was going on back then, not with the way it's going now.
Okay, well, is there any other discussion?
Micah had written a letter. Did you want to
read it? He did. He was just making the same comments that we made here, so if there's no other discussion, we'll move on to the training. That's what everybody's here for, is the training, is that right? Okay. Who's doing the training? Hey, is that you?
I have right here prepared this beautiful
to personal data gathered by governmental entities. Hello, and welcome to the Utah State Archives Government Records Access 101 course. I'm Monica Manaya, the Government Records Ombudsman, and I'll be taking you through today's online training. This course is designed to help give a general overview of Grandma and the key roles and responsibilities of the Record Officer and Chief Administrative Officer. For more in-depth training of Grandma, please take the certification course that is available on Archive's website. Today I'll be going over 3 minutes, how to respond to record requests, how to classify records, and how to navigate the appeals process. At the end of this course, I'll go over resources that are available within the transparency team and some tips on how to prepare for the State Records Committee. In this section, we'll be covering Part 1, General Provisions, and Part 2, Access to Records. What is Grandma, and why is it important? Grandma, Government Records Access and Management Act, is Utah's open record law. It was established in 1991 by the legislature. The intent of Grandma has a basis of recognizing 2 constitutional rights: the public's right to access information concerning the public's business, and the right of privacy in relation to personal data gathered by governmental entities. Grandma promotes the public's right to access unrestricted and public records while providing guidelines for both disclosure and restrictions on access to government records. There are 2 key roles within the Grandma process, the first being the appointed record officer, and the second being the chief administrative officer. The chief administrative officer duties are defined in archive statute. The CAO establishes and maintains policy, procedures, functions, and proper documentation of the organization. The CAO can designate someone to answer grandma appeals and have them listed as a CAD, and we'll cover more of this in the appeals section. The record officer duties are listed in Grandma, designated by the CAO as Archives Point Person for Records Management. They're responsible for maintenance of records and answering Grandma requests. The appointed record officer needs to be certified annually, and that is available on the Archives website. Also on our website is the Record Officer Hub. That will contain everything you need in regards to maintaining and updating records for your agency. Please make sure to keep all of the roles updated, but especially the Record Officer and Chief Administrative Officer roles. This is important for our office to know who to contact and who we can refer the public to contact as well. How to respond to record requests. First, let's start with, is it a proper request? A person making a request shall submit in writing their request needs to contain their name, mailing address, email address if they're willing to accept email communication, a daytime phone number, and lastly a description of records that identifies the record with reasonable specificity. Once you've verified that it is a written request, you'll acknowledge your receipt of the request and make sure to note a response if the requester is asking for their request to be expedited. Verify that it's a record that your agency has, or if not, notify the requester of that and who they should make the request to. Next is to identify responsive records. Determine whether or not it meets the criteria of a record. If you do not have the responsive records, were they destroyed due to your agency's retention schedule? And if so, make sure to make note of that when preparing your response to the requester. Once you have your responsive records, you'll move on to calculating the cost. Be sure to have an approved fee schedule for your agency. If the requester is asking for a fee waiver, be sure to address if you're granting or denying the fee waiver. You will also want to make note if the requester has listed a specific amount they're willing to pay. If the request is going over that amount, be sure to communicate that with the requester and get an understanding that they're willing to pay for the fee before you do the work. Keep in mind that you can request down payment if the amount exceeds $50. classify the responsive records. Go over the responsive records and classify them. For any record that you are denying access to, whether the classification is private, protected, or controlled, be sure to note what the record is and give the citation. Please note to give the full citation and not just it's private under 302. And lastly, you'll plan your response. When you are responding to a requester, you are approving, denying, or notifying the requester. If you are using an extraordinary circumstance, be sure to make note of the date the requester will be receiving the records, if no. Make sure to address all the items within the request in your response and include your CAO's information as well as the requester's right to appeal and the time frame that they will need to submit their appeal. Access to records, section 201. These are just a few key highlights from 201. The public has a right to inspect a public record. A governmental entity is not required to create a record or compile, format, summarize, or tailor information. However, they may upon request. A governmental entity may not use the physical form, electronic or otherwise, in which the record is stored to deny or reasonably hinder the rights of a person to inspect and receive a copy of the record under this chapter. Section 201 also goes over the provisions of public, private, protected, and controlled records, disclosure and non-disclosure, certified copy of records, and the limits of obligations when fulfilling a records request. Response time. Section 204 will be your time frame section. It'll give you an outline of when you need to respond to a request and the provisions that will allow you more time when needed. After receiving a records request, the agency shall no later than 10 business days or 5 business days if the requester asks for it to be expedited, approve, deny, or notify the requester of an extraordinary circumstance. As I mentioned before, there are 9 extraordinary circumstances that an agency may use to delay approval or denial by an additional time period. If the governmental agency fails to provide the records or issue a denial within the specified time frame, that failure is considered the equivalent of denying access to the record, and the requester may appeal to the CAO at that time. Denials. If you are denying access in whole or in part, you will need to supply the requester with the following information. A description of the records or the portion of the record which access was denied. Citations as outlined in grandma, state statute, or federal statute if those apply. Information that the requester has a right to appeal. Your agency's chief administrative officer information. And the time frame they will need to submit their appeal, which is 30 calendar days from the date of the denial. Please note that unless ordered by the court, a governmental entity shall not destroy or give up custody of the record to which access was denied until the period for an appeal has expired or the end of the appeals process. This will also include the judicial appeal process. In this section, we'll be going over Part 3 of Grandma, classification. Duty to classify records. You are not required to classify a record until it is requested, but knowing your records well enough and having a records management plan that clarifies where records are and what citations to look for will help you as you answer grammar requests. Under Section 307, entities are required to evaluate their record series, designate each series, and report that to the archives. This can be updated at any time. Retention schedules have classifications on them, but when you get a request, remember, you need to look at each responsive record and determine what its classification is. One record can have more than one classification, and in those cases, you'll redact what is not public and provide the rest. There are 4 classifications within Grandma: public, private, controlled, and protected. Furthermore, Grandma states that records are public unless expressly provided by statute. This means each request you get must be individually analyzed and carefully considered. A record can have more than one classification and require extensive redaction. Procedures for one entity might not translate well to another entity. Every entity has their own policies, and it's important to create your own framework and add to those policies as needed. We also like to note that it takes a lot of discretion to make these decisions on whether the requester is authorized to access the records. If you have any questions on if someone can have access to the records, please do not hesitate to contact the transparency team. Segregation. Don't forget to segregate. The primary tool for segregating records is to redact what cannot be provided by statute and release what is public. If a portion of the record isn't public but can be redacted or withheld somehow, so what is public can be provided, you can do that. And of course, the actual cost may be charged to the requester. As we've said, entities have the duty to designate and classify records. We'd like to take a moment to note that embarrassment and chilling effect is not a classification within Grandma. Please make sure when you are giving denial reasons to only give the statutes as outlined in Grandma or state or federal statutes. And how to find classifications. So for public records, there are two tiers. The first tier being must be disclosed but may contain confidential information. And the second tier is normally public unless otherwise stated. We'd also like to note that the list within public records is not exhaustive and should not be limited. It should not be used to limit access to records. Private records. Private records are separated into two tiers as well. The first tier are statutes that are always private, and the second tier is private if properly classified by the governmental entity. Just to note, a few things that could go into Tier 1 are employment records, and an example for Tier 2 are other records containing data of individuals, the disclosure of which constitutes a clearly unwarranted invasion of personal privacy. And controlled records. Controlled records are records that contain medical and psychiatric or psychological data, and if released would be detrimental to the mental health or safety of the subject of the record. So the difference between private and controlled medical records is that the private records can be accessed by the subject of the record, where controlled records can only be given access as outlined in Section 202, Subsection 2. And lastly, we have protected records. Protected records is everything else that is not public. The list grows every legislative session as records that have a strong public policy interest in non-disclosure and need to be specified in statute. Protected records include such things as trade secrets, jeopardizing the life or safety of an individual, attorney-client privilege, guarantee statements, and records concerning strategy about collective bargaining for imminent or pending litigation. In this section, we'll go over the appeal process and give information on the Ombudsman and State Records Committee. The appeal should have the requester's name, mailing address, daytime phone number, and a statement of relief they seek. If any of these are missing, it is an incomplete appeal. For incomplete appeals, we recommend good customer service by letting the requester know what they need to do to complete the appeal. A requester may appeal the denial of a fee waiver, records withheld or redactions made due to classification, a claim of extraordinary circumstances, or they may appeal the lack of response from the record officer. An appeal may also be regarding a response that no records exist. However, this appeal must be supported by evidence that the entity does or should maintain the record. There are a few things that a chief administrative officer needs to do when reviewing an appeal. First, an appeal should be filed within 30 calendar days of a denial, and if not, it's untimely. It's important to know that the CAO has the same deadline to respond as a records request, so within 5 business days if the requester is asking for it to be expedited, or 10 business days. Under Section 401, Subsection 5C, both parties can agree to extend the time period if needed. As I mentioned earlier, the CAO can designate someone to handle their grandma appeals on their behalf. That person, again, is listed as a CAD and should refer to themselves as a CAD when responding to a grandma appeal. When you have an appeal, the CAO needs to check if the appeal was correct. A few questions that you can do to ask to help with the appeal are, was a reasonable search done for the records? If not, you can order the record officer to do another search. Secondly, CAOs also can waive public interest. For some designations in Grandma, the CAO can exercise discretion to make an otherwise non-public record accessible. The interest favoring access are greater than or equal to the interest favoring restriction of access. You need to consider the public policies pertinent to the classification, disclosure, non-disclosure, and make sure other laws do not take precedence. If you have any questions about this part, you can reach out to the Government Records Ombudsman for help. If you deny the appeal, make sure to send a written notice of the decision affirming the denial. You'll also want to include that the requester has a right to appeal to the State Records Committee or District Court, and the time frame that they have to do so. Newly passed this year is that you are also required to include that the requester has a right to request mediation. Please also include the Government Records Ombudsman contact information within your denial. Now we're going to go into the State Records Committee. So there are 7 members on the committee: the State Archivist, 2 system members, a member of the media, a records manager from the private sector, a nominee from the Utah League of Cities and Towns, and someone with electronic records experience. A few timelines you should be aware of: our statement of facts are due no later than 5 business days before the hearing, and that you are required to send a copy of that to the requester by first-class mail. The Executive Secretary would like to note that the committee is made up of volunteers and none of them are lawyers, so brevity and plain language is always appreciated. 2 days before the hearing is the last day for the requester to ask to postpone. Current rules require the request to postpone to come from the petitioner, so we recommend working with the requester if you are unable to make the hearing. At the hearing, the committee may review the disputed records in camera. As a respondent, you are required to bring the records based out. The committee will vote on a motion at the meeting so everyone will know if the appeal is granted or denied. The order is then drafted and sent to the party 7 business days after the meeting. Parties have 30 days to comply with the order and file a notice of compliance or appeal to the district court. The biggest tip we can offer is to be prepared for your hearing. Often respondents are represented by an attorney, which is just fine, but make sure to meet with counsel before the hearing so they know about the records. It is also great to have the record officer at the meeting who can be called as a witness to answer the committee's questions about the records, how they are stored, and how the search was completed. So we'll go over the Ombudsman services. So I am able to mediate disputes, and also I'm a resource for the public and also for governmental entities in regards to Grandma. We do want to emphasize that you can work with the Ombudsman at any point within the request or appeal process. When a request or file is an appeal with the State Records Committee, the committee does expect parties to be willing to work with the Ombudsman in mediation to resolve as much of the appeal as possible. However, please note that your consent is needed to enter into mediation and can be withdrawn at any point within the process. If you have any questions about mediation, please contact the Ombudsman. So now I'm going to go into some resources that are available. So here is our transparency team. So we have the State Records Committee Executive Secretary, Rebecca Shaw, myself, Monica Vinaya, the Government Records Ombudsman, and Dylan Mace, who's over the Public Notice website and the Open Records Portal. Thank you for your time and attention throughout this training. Again, if you have any questions for us, please do not hesitate to contact us. We are here for you. Thank you.
Okay.
Beautiful, huh?
We're good?
You're all trained.
Very enlightening. Okay, well, that brings us to the council reports. I don't have anything to report tonight. But start with Darren.
I'll start with me. So our wonderful citizen, Patty Wise, attended, former city councilman, attended our Potem Vitro committee. I don't know, is that what you guys call it? And why don't you give a report? That would be fun. Okay.
You're the council person.
Okay. She, so they did the, as we know, we've talked a lot about the ORPA study that they did, and they reported on an actual, so Patty, Arthur LeBaron, Dave Jessup from Washington County Water, Leslie Fonger from Washington County, Vernon Malloy, and John Jacobson from Sunrise, laid out a detailed primary route for the trail that's going to go up through there. And the trail will start at the Dean Cox Bridge here in Confluence on the Hurricane side and stay mainly out of the floodplain. First bridge from Hurricane to the Hurricane side is just west of SR9. That's kind of down where that building is down there.
You'll know before that west.
Okay. Trail stays on the Leverican side until it crosses back to Hurricane on the old historic bridge. Sensitive water district, city and hot springs equipment will be worked around. Trail stays on the Hurricane side for a couple of miles, crosses over to Leverican and then back to Hurricane shortly before the stem traps. And the trail will cross back over to Leverican to head up the Jeep Trail. This alignment is proving difficult due to steepness, and the trail may need to be outside the current road footprint. From there, it will connect with the Zion Corridor Trail on SR9, and the next meeting they'll finalize some of the problem areas. They also, from the ZRC committee, I listened in on a little bit of that, thanks to Patty, let me know about it. We got a lot of updates from the different areas. There's so many fun trails that people are talking about. Tocqueville has a lot going on with the Firelight community, and it's going to be exciting if we can get some of these trails in. We also talked about some of the legislation that might affect things that are going on down here, and talked about grants. So the Leverican Overlook Trail signs have been ordered. They'll take about 6 weeks, and they'll be installed by Sean Green, and that's my report. Volunteers needed for that, putting up those signs.
Thank you. Scott?
As Nick mentioned, the fire district meeting didn't occur at the beginning of this week because they're still working on putting together the quorum. Did have a chance to be able to go over to the ribbon cutting over at the Confluence plant. It was, I mean, really pretty astounding what kind of what kind of a facility that was and what the potential of that is to be able to help with really being able to take care of the current citizens. What an excellent plan to be able to have a state-of-the-art facility right there in our area, built right in a neighborhood that mitigates noise and smell considerations to the environment. I thought it was really something state-of-the-art, some real good stewardship and forethought put into the planning of the plant and its execution, what it takes to be able to have it under operation for the upcoming years. Really, everything about that really makes you proud to be a member of Washington County and to be able to see our tax dollars that go towards Ash Creek Special Service District be used with, you know, prudence and stewardship. I was completely impressed. So,
good. Thank you, Amanda.
All right. Well, the Washington County Solid Waste meeting is next week, so I will have a report on that the week after at our next meeting. And I still need to touch base with the Historical Preservation crew and get with them. So, nothing new though.
Thank you. John?
Same thing, the first meeting of the mosquito abatement group will be next week. The recent meeting of planning and zoning, there was cancellation of the DADU issue, so I think that's going to be rescheduled for the next meeting. The Planning Commission is going through a number of older city code issues. And right now they're looking at revamping general commercial, retail commercial, and forest commercial zones, mixed use zones, and they're looking at a priority list for upcoming activities. The legislative committee is interesting. The state now has about 890 bills. I think the governor signed 10. Most of them are really in some form of manipulation. A lot of them deal with property tax, and there are some with property use. But these things will probably get a little bit firmer in the next maybe week or so. So by our next session, there may be a lot more report.
Okay, thank you. Hey?
I don't have anything in particular to report.
Okay, thank you. One note is that did we make the hire on a new police officer?
No.
Made the offer?
No, we have not.
Oh, okay.
We're still, the top three all have previous work history and PDs. So we're just going through the background investigations and that portion. So I hope to, I have a meeting with Post tomorrow. They do like a Zoom kind of meeting now, instead of getting paperwork funneled to us now. So that's tomorrow, and that'll clarify and narrow it down to that at least the top two. And hopefully on next Monday I can go to Kyle.
Okay, thank you. Well, that brings us to the citizen comment. Any item that the citizens would like to bring to the council that wasn't on the agenda, we'd like to invite you to come up and address the council. We'll give you 3 minutes to do so, and now it's open for citizen comment if any of you'd like to come up and comment. Dave Olson. State your name and for the record.
Yes, David Olson. I know you haven't brought this up, but it's been brought up before, more for the planning and zoning. I'm just going to read this statement. It is no accident that a nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to justice for all should protect property rights. Property is the foundation of every right we have, including the right to be free. It would be of no avail, however, if property once acquired could not be used and enjoyed. The presumption of common law or constitutional law was ordinarily on the side of free use. People were not required to obtain a permit before using their property. That is, just as people were not required to obtain a permit before speaking. Thus, the common law limits the right of free use only when a use encroaches on the property rights of others. From the World Economic Forum at Davos, I found an interesting quote. Human rights are just like heaven and like God. It's just a fictional story. We are no longer mysterious souls. Indeed, any God-fearing man or woman would find this troubling. No longer sons and daughters of God, and we no longer enjoy the God-given rights protected by the Constitution. I can assure you that there is a God, even the source of all life and goodness in the universe. He is also the source of inspiration behind the Constitution and Bill of Rights. And as free citizens, we do enjoy these rights protected by the Constitution. When these rights were first recognized by our founding fathers, they were extremely important. Nowadays, we generally give a wink and a nod. Not that important. So I feel the need to read this morning. Every person, this includes every government official, who, under the color of law, deprives any citizen of rights, privileges, or immunities secured by the United States Constitution, is subject to civil and or criminal penalties pursuant to Title 42 United States Code and Title 18 United States Code. Penalties include up to $10,000 fine and or 10 years in prison or both. Apparently, they took these rights very seriously. Would that you would be mindful of them in planning and zoning. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Anybody else like to make some comments? If not, we stand adjourned. Thanks for coming this evening.